Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're interviewing Dr. Francesca Lopez, who's the Waterbury Chair in Equity Pedagogy and a Professor of Education in the College of Education at Penn State. Dr. Lopez's research aims to inform policymakers, school leaders, and teacher educators about policies and classroom practices that can mitigate inequities. In this month's podcast, Dr. Lopez describes her research examining asset-based pedagogy's programs and practices and their impact on students and teachers. So, in recent years, a subset of federal and state policymakers have leveraged attacks on K-12 public schools. And in particular, these attacks have been lobbied at students who have certain identities. So we can think about anti-CRT bills, anti-ethnic studies laws, attacks on the languages that students speak, their immigration status, and anti-LGBTQ legislation. I want to start by asking you about your work because, or your early work, because so much of it has focused on educational practices, programs, policies that have emerged during moments of attacks on public schools, and also in the wake of attacks on public schools. So what do we know about that kind of process of the development of policies, programs, practices that support kids in asset-based ways during these moments of attacks on public education?
If I think back to what got me started in the work that I do, you know, it really was, I was a bilingual teacher in Texas. I myself spoke Spanish before I learned English, and I entered the classroom and ended up in Arizona. And so Arizona is a very important place because I did a lot of my research there. But to contextualize what I'm responding to, in the late 1990s, we'll start there, late 1990s, early 2000s, we saw a very coordinated attack on bilingual education. It happened in California, Arizona. There was an attempt in Colorado that did not happen. And Kathy Escamilla has written beautifully about what happened there. And then Massachusetts is the other location. And they all shared the same individual in common. But the policies, because they were situated in different contexts, look a little bit different. So in California, the ban on bilingual education still allowed for a waiver for parents to be able to make sure that their children could access bilingual education. That was not the case in Arizona. It was, out of all of the states that I mentioned, the most restrictive. Arizona prides itself on being English first, so even immersion contexts, Latino Spanish speaking students would not have access to. And we really are talking about an identity of Latino students, because about 70% of our quote unquote English learners are Spanish-speaking students, right? Or they speak Spanish at home. And so with these attacks that happened, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, at the very soon after that, this coalition of community members begins to work in Tucson, Arizona, to establish what later became known as MAS, the Mexican American Studies Program, Ethnic Studies. And they work together. There's a lot of nuance that goes on, but they get it implemented. And then the attacks on that program begin in 2010 with the banning of it in 2012. Right around that time, the district where the ethnic studies classes had taken place had been under a court desegregation oversight, but not really monitored, and had been released, but the plaintiffs filed a complaint and they won. And so because it was such a complicated case, and the last school district in the state to still be under desegregation order, they appointed what was known as a special master to the case. And I believe it was 2012. It was this individual, knowing desegregation scholar, had known about different desegregation cases all over the place. And in a conversation with him, he shared with me, his name was Willis Holly, that he really saw this as his last chance to implement something magical. And his approach, in his words, was, "I threw spaghetti at the wall." And so anything he could deem a practice that would help the district, he would help create or support infrastructures that were supervised by the court. One of those being the creation of the Culturally Responsive Pedagogy and Instruction Department that included some former Mexican American Studies educators. It was in that place that the district then he saw the work that the MAS teachers had done as, in his words, magic. They had something very special. It was something that was, and he had requested reports because it became a student filed a suit and it was deemed a first and 14th constitutional violation for students, but way until like 2017. So a lot happened between the time he became the special master and that decision had been made. Part of it being, let's implement these classes. And so he put the director kind of in charge of coming up with, it was at the time known as the three-year plan. And in this three-year plan is how do we make sure every adult, right, in the district receives training to do something similar in the spirit of what the MAS teachers had been doing. And that became a district University of Arizona partnership where a lot of theory and research met with practice, and many, many teachers were then receiving professional development and training and coaching. It was the largest professional development endeavor I had ever been part of, that I had ever seen. And you ask people in the district and they will say it's part of their DNA. I mean, it's just something that they became very, very used to. One of the things that also occurred, however, is this is a district that had faced literal policing of people showing up to classrooms and taking books from shelves. This happened during the bilingual education ban. It definitely happened during the MAS ban, taking, and we're seeing that in today's book bans, right? It's very similar behaviors. And so what the special master helped navigate is the use of language so that with the court's protection, they weren't violating any policy that was in place. So rather than use language that would create or incite some political intervention, they used language that they would then define. And one clear example is they wouldn't call them ethnic studies or MAS classes. They were CR classes, culturally responsive classes. They would use the terms culturally responsive and culturally relevant. Depending, culturally relevant was more about the curriculum. It was relevant to the students who were being taught. Culturally responsive was like the behaviors and meeting students' needs and affirming, which makes perfect sense, right? But you say that to scholars and they'll define it a little bit different. So, so it's interesting because these policies did not occur because of each other to some extent, but the responses, the special master's response was in response to that. And then there were definitely community efforts surrounding this. Arizona to date still has that policy. It's been rescinded in Massachusetts and California. And before the current superintendent of public instruction was elected, Tom Horn, they had actually reduced the restrictions. And I can go into detail on that one. But it is removing students for 4 hours a day. We don't learn language that like that. It is not research-based. And so there had been some momentum policy-wise, reducing that, allowing access to dual language, for example, where students could, you know, be in the classroom where Spanish and English is spoken, despite the English first policy. But with this new superintendent, there's been a lot of efforts to counter some of the progress that's been made.
It's interesting because it's given the time that we're in, given kind of the depressing mood that could be taken because of all of the attacks on public schools, you're providing an example of how people in school districts and in schools can have a totally different vision for how they're going to serve kids in spite of legislation, even though we know that that makes it harder, right? You describe the folks coming into schools similar to what's happening now with book bans. I'm curious if we know anything about what these programs, the PDs you described, the opportunities that were afforded to kids, do we know what that means to kids? right? Like policymakers had a very different vision for what they wanted schools to be and how they wanted kids to experience school. Educators took a very different path in the world that you're describing. What do we know what that meant for the kids that were afforded those opportunities?
We do. And there is research to show us just how important it is to students to see themselves in the curriculum, to get a perspective that they don't typically get. I'm going to mirror the words of one of the MAS teachers, Jose Gonzalez, who said, if we need any evidence as to whether a curriculum that reflects students works, all you have to do is look at how, in general, more privileged students perform, right? He said that is the traditional curriculum, and they see themselves in the history, and it's affirming. And so ethnic studies and other more asset-based practices is a way to have students' senses of identity be promoted. So we know from developmental research, for example, how important our identities are, not only in adolescence. That is a critical time of exploration. But before that, you know, are we members of a stigmatized group? That matters for how we interpret the kinds of things we're exposed to in classrooms. Is that stigma one that I may underperform if I am not explicitly told about this? Yes, we know that through research on stereotype threat. We know this through research on biases and how they play out. We also have really robust evidence in ethnic studies on how very powerful, not only in Tucson, there's research out of California as well that has documented it helps attendance, it helps GPA, it helps graduation rates, achievement scores, college matriculation, all the things that we know are predictive of more longer term success, right? And so the understanding of what is the underlying mechanism that makes these things work is basically an uncovering of a truth. I currently have a doctoral student, Giselle Delcid, who was an MAS student. And when she talks about the classes, she said, you know, I knew what it was like to live where I lived because it was where I lived and we all saw it. But what the MAS classes did is they helped us name the things that we were seeing and understand that it wasn't a given, that we weren't destined to that, that there were decisions that had been made by policies that led to food deserts where we lived, that led to our inability to access certain things. And she said, and there's so much power in that because then there's agency to resolve those things rather than this is just how it is. So, I mean, across multiple disciplines, we have quite a bit of evidence that demonstrates just how important different access to textbooks is, right? Seeing a narrative that might be different, seeing examples of people who look, sound like me, in some of the research that we've done in those classes, English language arts, then learning about other populations who suffer similar things and understanding that this is a common phenomenon and how do you build solidarity. So it's very psychologically powerful. It's very curiosity forward because it leads for students to think, well, how can I solve this? If we can get at the root of what the sources of what we're seeing is, then let's find solutions to turn those around.
I want to move to a different group, teachers, and I want to ask you about whether we know anything about what these programs, PDs, policies meant for the experiences of teachers. And I'm thinking in particular, we live in a world where we constantly hear about teacher shortages, where we constantly teach about, or we constantly hear about teachers leaving the profession. And we know that in recent years, there's been more of a conceptualization and an understanding around why this is happening. We often thought about it as burnout or as lack of pay. But I know Dora Santoro's work talks about demoralization, right? Like the fact that teachers aren't able to do what it is that they morally think is right by their kids. So I'm wondering if we know anything about how teachers experience this process, these PDs, and what it meant for their identities and their professional pathways.
It's such a wonderful question to ask because you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm a former educator, well, a former teacher. I'm still an educator. And it's such a unique experience to have learned with and from the educators in this particular district in Tucson Unified, because the level of professionalization is unsurpassed. When we worked together, they were reading, it was like graduate classes, and they were 100% invested, committed. It was time outside of their contract period. It was weekends. It was such a commitment and devotion to their professionalization that I think that matters greatly, because people, I think generally speaking, who enter education want to make a difference in the lives of students. People know going into it, it is not the most lucrative of careers. We know from the news, I remember when I started my academic career in a college of education in Wisconsin, parents were dissuading their children from going into education because the pay was just not great. But the will of, you know, people wanting to go into it. So I'm really glad you brought up, you know, we know that there's a crisis in terms of the workforce. Pay can be a big one, but the moment we take pay off the table, we do know from research, we need to have something that allows us to have choice, agency, autonomy. And we're talking about professionals who have gone to get their degree, who have studied, who understand child and adolescent development, who understand their content area, who understand different ways of delivering that. And so when you have educators whose entire purpose is to spark and nurture and sustain learning and learn from their students and give them a place where they get to do that, many of the people I worked with all those years ago are still there. They do not have plans to leave the profession because they are so committed. And this is an estate that is, if they're not the lowest in terms of teacher salary, it is the lowest. And that is shameful because what they do is so important. But the point is they stayed because it was so important to them. I mean, I've had multiple conversations and can expand on that. But I think if I had to pinpoint what was the magic that happened, it was they were treated like intellectuals who were serious about their roles. And then they had the autonomy, right, to actually see what that would look like in their classroom. Some did leave. The ones that left because they were not in a context, in a particular setting where they were being supported. And that falls in tandem with what we're seeing with reports of, if education leaders do not support teachers, if they don't have their back, then they're kind of at the mercy of the things and the censorship and the fears, right? We see teacher self-censoring. But if they have a strong leader who backs up the practices with the whys and has a community that's involved, then we see those teachers thrive.
Obviously, the attacks now are different. They are better funded, for one example of how they're different. They're multifaceted. They're attacking students and schools and teachers in a multitude of ways. Given your experience with asset-based pedagogy, asset-based programs, what are you perhaps most concerned about the current attacks? Where are you looking to for hope?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because I'm just coming off of a convening that we had in DC, and it was an interdisciplinary convening where we had a political scientist, a historian, a communication psychologist, but I led the convening and helped organize it with a colleague. But the very first group that I wanted everybody to hear from was a current school board president, an advocate for schools, a superintendent. And the one thing that all of these individuals had in common was that in their roles, they have had death threats. So things are different, because not that death threats and those vitriolic attacks are new, but the ease in which people can take a picture, post it, and spread it. The school board president said, they found pictures of my children. They posted my address, and the district had to send police escorts wherever I went. that is scary. And I talk about a chill factor, right? When you get somebody that's making progress toward equity, and because of this, a threat on their life. So it is a life and death situation. I think things have gotten so out of hand that it's not tenable, but the chill factor works. Other people might see that and think it's not worth it. And we've seen that through surveys that both teachers and leaders, over time, they've always thought the stress of the job was still worth it because of, you know, the students. But we've reached a point that because it's creeped so much into their own personal life and mental health and fears for safety, that they no longer really believe, like, it's dropped by half in terms of how many really think. So that those are bad stats. That's a horrible situation that we find ourselves in. And it's unconscionable to me that we do not have more political leaders standing up and denouncing it. We saw it with LBJ, right? And we need a return to that kind of pushback of saying this kind of behavior is unacceptable as a society. And I think to your second part of the question, do we see any, you know, opportunities, doors that might open? We absolutely have that right now. What we have is a vast majority of families. I think Learning Heroes, when they did the survey in 2021, found that about 70% of them, the number one thing that had them concerned was that politicians who were not educators were making decisions about what goes on in the classroom. And parents are not okay with that. A more recent NEA survey that went out found that 84% of people out there, voters across political lines, trust educators. So we have a vast majority of people that, given the right talking points, understanding, initiatives to step up and back up educators and get more involved, that we could turn the tide. It's one of those things that I often use the bullying literature to kind of explain. We know that many, many times we can stop bullying by empowering bystanders, because we know people who are just there kind of watching are frozen and don't know what to do, how to intervene to stop the behavior. But once they're given those tools, they can step up and stop it. So those are some of the things that I think are huge opportunities that we need to lean in on, because we know people don't feel that way, but hoping someone else will step in is not going to help. If anything, it's going to keep chipping away at the morale, at people wanting to stay in the classroom, at parents wanting to remove their students from a particular school, and so on.
That's a great segue for me to ask you about researchers. When you think about the convening that you just did, all these folks who are, you know, trained to ask questions, how can researchers engage in the process and support the process that you just described of reaching that 70% of people who are concerned about the misalignment between politicians and their understanding? How can we reach those politicians too and like help their understanding? Like, how, given your research, what is the role of researchers in like speaking to this, and what are the challenges in doing that?
So, you know, I think there are many, many researchers who really want to be part of the solution. I mean, we saw so many funded efforts go in, and they resulted in like John Rogers, Michael Pollack, the reports out of UCLA, amazing wealth of knowledge, the CRP RAND report, amazing wealth of knowledge. And so in understanding bits and pieces of how we got to now, what are the strategies, what can we really do to support? There's quite a bit that researchers can do and I think are doing. I think there's that effort going on. However, right, one of the big issues I think we face as researchers is that often we really do need funding to be able to do the kind of research that ends up published in peer-reviewed journals. And the other issue to that is time, right? It takes a very long time from start to finish to submit a proposal, to get funding, to carry out the study, to write it. I mean, we're talking years from now. We will have a different president by the time people are submitting things. And that's a concern. I had a conversation with somebody who used to work for a philanthropy and left when the philanthropy's mission was not really about equity, and that became very evident. And the conversation, we were going back and forth, and I voiced my frustration with the fact that what those of us who are researchers are up against is such a well and deeply funded group of think tanks that are so interconnected, that spread information and ideology so easily because they have the funding for media outlets. They have these machines that crank out information that we do not have. And the person I was speaking to said, well, it's not only that. Philanthropy for the far right is they give people money and they're like, we trust what you're going to do with that. No questions asked. Here's the funding. And they just keep giving to that piggy bank. Whereas those of us who still believe in doing peer-reviewed, robust research have to go through these arduous processes. And even then, philanthropy that might support us still wants to vet to a certain extent what it is we're doing and what we're not doing. It is an unparalleled comparison between how they can do the things that they do and what we do. And that's a conundrum. I mean, that's a huge frustration, because what we're talking about is trying to do research that helps get into the hands of people to turn something around quickly. So there's a couple of things that I see we really need to do. One is the response. We need to help leaders and teachers and families and students with the right mechanisms of response. And I think other disciplines outside of education have been doing that already. We have a lot to learn from them. But there is material that we can take and hit the ground running. But then there's the long game. I think we are so used to, I mean, I mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation, like the bans in the 90s and then the ban on ethnic studies. And then now here we are with the DEI bans and, you know, SEL, and they're just dumping a bunch of things in there. And we're constantly being reactive. And that is not what the far right has done. They play the long game. They use the same strategy, and then they leverage the tools. And in our case now, it's social media and it's having all these things. And I think those of us that want to counter that with evidence that is truly better for everybody, right? We need to get better at thinking through infrastructure, mechanisms that will help us see this through the long term and not just the short term.
Thank you, Dr. Lopez, for being on this month's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember, for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu.